This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Before we bring you our conversation on another serious topic, a police officer in the community of East Liverpool, Ohio, is recovering after authorities said that he had accidentally touched and overdosed himself on fentanyl that had been seized during an arrest. Patrolman Chris Green had stopped a vehicle driven by a 25-year-old man on Friday after he spotted someone in the vehicle perform a drug transaction. And that was when Officer Green noticed white powder on the car seat and the floor, as well as on the man that he had stopped and another passenger's shoes and clothing. And officers say that Green then arrested the two men, and he followed protocol by putting on gloves and a mask to search the vehicle. When Officer Green got back to his patrol station, another officer noticed he had some of that white powder on his shirt. Well, out of instinct, he said he just tried to brush it off, but he didn't think. And about an hour later, authorities say that Officer Green passed out at the police station. Overdosing on this white powder was later determined to be fentanyl. The drug can get into the body just through contact with the skin. And according to the East Liverpool Police Captain Patrick Wright, an ambulance was called and responded, and they gave Officer Green a dose of Narcan and then took him to a hospital where they gave him three more doses of Narcan. And since then, he's recovered. He's in good shape, according to the police chief. And told the TV reporter that the incident was a scary example of how the drug epidemic has forced police officers to change aspects of their job. So now, where they used to be able to field test drugs, they don't do that any longer because of such accidental exposures. And unfortunately, there are some accidental exposures and some other problems to note as well. And we've been told about another serious drug. We're aware, of course, the usual opioids that are around, it seems, these days, that treatment centers like Recovery Works, which is based in Maryville, is dealing with every single day. Now we understand there is one called Gray Death. And to talk about that and some other related topics dealing with the opioid crisis here in Northwest Indiana, we have Valerie Thorne, who is the Executive Director of Recovery Works in Maryville. It's part of the Pinnacle Treatment Network. Valerie, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Nolte.
If you will, tell us a little bit of what Gray Death is, why, and it's come out in the fact there's a story on CNN here about it that apparently it has a lot of authorities very, very puzzled as to, I guess, what this is all about and the impact it's going to have as they try to battle the overall opioid addiction process.
That is correct. And so one of the things is we recently have seen that Gray Death is resistant to Narcan. A large part of that is because it is includes carfentanil, which is much stronger than the fentanyl we have in this country. And so it has been headed to our area. We have seen it in Ohio, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania, and just recently in Indianapolis. And so it is impacting our community. We have seen a few patients whom we've had to administer in this region 5 to 6 times of the Narcan before it was effective. So it is in the region.
I have heard one description of how potent carfentanil is, that a single flake of it could anesthetize an elephant. Is this pretty true? It's not very far-fetched?
That is very true.
Sounds like it's something that I guess of carfentanil, we've known about fentanyl for quite some time, and I know it's shown up here in Northwest Indiana. Is this a new introduction of something stronger? And if it is, where does it seem to be coming from?
Well, and from the police reports, it appears that it is coming from overseas, and it's coming through customs. And so with that being said, it has a tendency to get past a lot of the things that we have as safeguards here in this country. And so it is coming up through some of the southern states, mm-hmm. according to the police reports that I have read.
From what you understand, how can this get past the customs? Is it just a way that they can, because of what it is, they can smuggle it around other ways that maybe aren't easy to touch? Or maybe the drug testing methods that are out there don't detect it?
Well, I would not be able to speak to that because mm-hmm. that would be a U.S. Customs thing. I couldn't say why it's coming through. But as it's been in this country for such a long time, there are many different ways that people learn how to get it through.
One of the things the article in CNN talks about in more detail, in talking with people that they had talked to, forensic chemists and the like, and they mentioned about this, the problem about whether they determined it's some kind of compound that they hadn't yet discovered. But apparently, as you say, at least the components of it have been around for a while.
Correct.
Is there any reason why maybe it's just now, we're just learning now about the Gray Death?
Probably because I would presume that when people utilize these substances, that they experiment with different substances when they're mixing it. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't speak to that, but we would presume that based on the compounds that are coming up with Gray Death.
Okay. When folks come into the Recovery Works facility in Maryville, they've had problems, and you talk with them and counsel with them and then get them help, because the facility, by the way, is a multifaceted treatment facility. Not only is taking care of outpatients, but there's also a residential program as well too. How do all the programs that Recovery Works have available to them help with these people and not necessarily dealing with such a strong compound as this Gray Death, but just the, hate to say, run of the mill opioids that you run into every single day?
Well, sadly, when an individual takes this substance, many individuals wind up dead because the drug is Narcan resistant. And as I said earlier, you know, 5 to 6 times before somebody is able to reverse the overdose. But people believe that they're actually taking heroin when they're taking the fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue that we have, or the carfentanil. And both are lethal substances. Our hope is to get them into treatment, okay, prior to, more of a prevention before they get the substance, because they don't know what they're getting. And so we want to get them into treatment. And our phone number is 866-535-HOPE. And so one of the things is getting them into treatment, educating them on the treatment, providing them the services that they need through detox, residential, counseling, and also through our intensive outpatient program, so that they can follow that process to help them so that they're not using substances. So we want to get them before they have the accident of the carfentanil or the Gray Death.
So obviously you're talking about people that somehow or another have become addicted to heroin, certainly, or cocaine, and heroin in particular, because you say that the heroin and these fentanyl, carfentanil, they're so much alike, and they look alike. And somebody, as you say, somebody could overdose it or get hold of it even and not know what they're getting.
Correct. That is correct. And so we're hoping to get them into treatment before, and with all of the news explaining right now that, you know, Gray Death and carfentanil and all of these things are a real concern, hoping that people will come into treatment before they accidentally get that substance.
I guess, although fortunate for us, not for the people that live in those areas, but I guess most of the deaths that have been reported from the Gray Death so far from carfentanil have happened in the South. And I guess because you mentioned that's what the area where it seems to have gotten its way into the country is in through the South. And I guess we're getting alerts all across the country now from this problem that's cropped up down in Alabama and other states down there.
That is very true. And so because of that, we also have treatment facilities in Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania. We're actually opening up some new facilities because this is a very dangerous, dangerous situation. And young people are dying and people who don't realize what they're getting in the substances that they're purchasing.
How difficult has it been for the chemists and the forensic analysts to, once they get wind of this substance that's out there, how difficult is it for them to try to look into it further and see what much damage it really can do? Is it relatively easy, or is it because things have happened so quickly that it's just kind of overwhelmed everybody?
And I believe that it's the latter, that it has just overwhelmed everybody. It wasn't anything that they were expecting that we were going to be dealing with in such a short period of time.
We're talking with Valerie Thorne, who is the executive director of the Recovery Works facility in Northwest Indiana. They're based in Maryville. It's a facility that offers not only outpatient, residential, and transitional living services to people that have drug abuse problems, trying to help them get out of the situation that they are in. And it sounds like with some of these very, very potent, very serious drugs, to just keep them alive. When we're having issues like this, that we come across these new drugs, or at least they're we're discovering them new. They're not new, as you say. Fentanyl, carfentanil have been around for a while. Is there anything that the authorities can do, since they're dealing with this, and we've just talked about this one example of the police officer from Ohio who accidentally overdosed himself because he had fentanyl on his clothing, not knowing what he actually had, although he knew it was probably drugs of some type. When we're dealing with this, and it only took, hopefully it helped this one officer out with the several doses of Narcan, police officers that come across this every single day, certainly here in Northwest Indiana and other places, don't keep that much, Narcan or related drugs around to be able to help deal with these sudden dose overdoses like this. What can they do, or what are they hoping they're going to be able to do?
Well, I do know that the overdose out of Indianapolis is really working to get a lot of the individuals and facilities, as well as police department, fire department, all of them to have Narcan on them. So they're working very diligently. And we're working with the police departments and law enforcement and communities to bring awareness to the dangers to get these people in for treatment before it is too late. So one of the things I recommend is for friends, neighbors, family, to actually be on the lookout for any of their friends, family members, or neighbors who that might be impacted. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes people don't want to address the issue of drugs, but it's in the news every single day. And so I encourage them to seek treatment before they come into contact with the substance. So working with the police department, working with all of the school systems and things along that line to help get these people into treatment before it is too late.
Are there any warning signs? I think we always think that there are signs we see of people that have been taking cocaine or they're on heroin, and there are signs that you can tell if somebody is having problems. Is there anything that anybody can do or be aware of? Any warning signs, I suppose, before they get involved so heavily into something that they can kill them almost instantly?
Well, it would have to be, changes in behaviors. And we always talked about, opiates starting out in actually the home where people have leftover prescriptions. And I know that they're working for medication-assisted treatment for these individuals. So trying to help them understand, if you don't have any medications that you have left over, please discard them appropriately. And I know the police departments are working to have that happen as well so that they don't have these opiates, because a lot of times it happens in the home and people don't realize that just having those old prescriptions are part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. That's the long-standing problem. We say people always have leftover prescriptions, and before we were just dealing with just some things that just, were basically just mild painkillers to get over some surgery or some other problems like that. But now we're talking into much, much more potent, more dangerous drugs, I suppose, that people are taking, I guess, and some of them, I'm sure, can't wean themselves off it after they've gotten rid of the pain from whatever they've had, either surgery or broken bones or something like that.
And a lot of people don't understand that some of the opiates that we have out there are very, very addictive from the first time you take them. And so with that being said, the old adage about what an addict looked like is not the same as it is today. Mm-hmm. And so with that being said, one of the things that we try to do is help people understand that once they take the medication, okay, whether it's for surgery or whatever reason, that there is the potential for them to get addicted because it is so powerful. And so what we want them to do is understand that they have to be the ones to say, I'm not going to do this. I'm moving forward. I'm only going to take a few of them, because it can be very difficult for them to get off of it. And an addict that we used to think of is not the addict of today. They can be from just taking one prescription of medication, and then they can become addicted.
If anybody listening to our conversation has concerns, they have family members that they're worried about, how can they get more information from RecoveryWorks?
Our number is 866-535-HOPE. We are located in Merrillville, Indiana. Our other phone number, local phone number, is 219-472-0066. But we also have facilities in Kentucky. We have facilities for individuals who may not want to stay in the region, because sometimes mm-hmm. moving away helps them to get sober. And so we also have some in Pennsylvania, New Jersey as well.
And there's one other facility, I understand, that's just opened up about the same time as the Merrillville facility here in Indiana, another part of the state.
That is correct. We have one in Cambridge City, and we also have Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. So I apologize that I forgot to mention those.
Well, that's all right. Valerie Thorne is executive director of the Recovery Works facility that's based in Merrillville. It's part of the Pinnacle Treatment Network. Valerie, thank you very much for giving us some insight here about the gray death and how serious the problem it is. We I had just only one example of a police officer who's come up across the problems of fentanyl, and we know that there are much more serious drugs that are out there now that we're having to deal with, and police officers and the unfortunately the medical examiners and coroners across the state and across the country are having to deal with the aftermath of people that have unfortunately been taking these drugs. I'm sure probably some by mistake as well too. Valerie, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate that.
Coming up, we will have more dealing with the issue of opioids, the conversation that was aired recently on Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon. Opioids are the miracle drugs that can take all the pain away. But when the healing is done and the pain disappears, you have a choice. Throw away the remaining pills, let them sit in the medicine cabinet, or use them up, even if you don't have pain. Prescription drugs have killed more people than car crashes and gun violence. So what do we do? Well, that is the topic for a recent Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon conversation with Gerard and his guests, Dr. Janice Seabrook of the Community Health Net and Ronald Williams of Edgewater Systems. The program originally aired back in mid-January, just before Counterpoint took its end-of-season break. And we bring you that conversation now.
First question here is on regulations and the strictness of regulations that we should have on opioids. As I mentioned in the open, I had surgery on my heart. They had to open my chest up. I had a tumor that was floating around on my aorta. After the surgery, of course, you're in intense pain, immense pain. So you're given painkillers, okay? Mm-hmm. Should you be given painkillers? Of course, because it hurts. It can be unbearable on some days. But I ask the two of you, should regulations on drugs and prescriptions be more strict? What do you think, Dr. Janet Seabrook?
Well, in your case, looking at you having a medical procedure that was genuine and they're called for the need to have pain medications. In answer to your question in regards to should there be restrictions and limitations, each state has the ability to control the substances that providers are able to write prescriptions for. And with the state of Indiana, we have a resource, a tool, and it's called INSPECT, and it's all capital letters. INSPECT is a web-based resource that providers in the state of Indiana can go in and take a look at the number of prescriptions, who provided the prescriptions, and how many times they were refilled. And this is how we're able to work in concert with the pharmacists, the local pharmacists throughout the state of Indiana, to be in communication to be able to monitor INSPECT.
Okay, this is interesting. See, yes. you opened it up here. So it's state by state when it comes to regulation, and Indiana chooses to have this INSPECT to make sure or to monitor what prescriptions are being written and the number of prescriptions. What's the reason for that? Is it a qualitative, a quantitative reason? Is it a reason for accountability and possibly abuse of writing prescriptions? What's the purpose?
It's multifactorial, but the basic fact was for tracking and monitoring the prescriptions that were being written and filled by pharmacists. Mm-hmm. Also, it helps to alert providers, and we can also alert pharmacies mm-hmm. when our prescription pads have been removed from our offices. So it's a two-way, it's a bi-directional line of communication that we have through INSPECT with pharmacists throughout the state.
Okay, this is very good. And I had no idea that we were going to get this deep, this quickly into this show, because I've always wondered about prescription monitoring. That's a lot of power for an MD to have. And I want to go to Ronald Williams. Drug addiction counseling. Is it real? Is this something real? Can you really counsel a person who is abusing opioids? And where does one start when it comes to drug addiction counseling, Ronald Williams?
Well, Gerard, it's very real. It's absolutely necessary. But to kind of dovetail on the conversation you guys were having, I know that when I go to the doctor and I have a tooth pulled or I have some issue that stipulates that I may need some relief from pain. I'll get a prescription for whatever that drug is, a codeine, whatever it is, and they won't put a refill on it, okay? They'll assume that they're going to give me this prescription for this amount of doses, and after that, that I should be fine. Mm-hmm. When you start to talk about the addiction, the emotional, the mental component, the need for counseling, is when you look at how people get the medications past that point. Oh. Now I'm starting to manipulate my doctor and manipulate the situation to justify ongoing need for the substance.
Oh, okay, okay. So, Ronald Williams, the manipulation of the medical doctor, is this common practice?
For the addict, manipulation is a prerequisite for joining the club. Ooh. So it presents itself in every area of that person's life.
How does this manipulation manifest itself? By saying, still kind of in pain, doctor, probably need to come see you to get another script? Or does the doctor voluntarily give another script without possibly notifying or even asking the patient if they want more? How does this happen? How does this occur?
I think that from what I hear from a lot of people that I see, it's a combination of mm-hmm. all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Seabrook, who's responsible for prescription drug opioid addiction and abuse? It's a loaded question.
It is.
I see you smiling. You really want to get in. You want to interrupt me because you're Dr. Janice Seabrook. But I always, I think about this a lot. The accessibility of opioids, very powerful drugs, Percocet, Vicodin, hydrocodone, Oxycontin. This stuff is powerful stuff.
Yes, it is.
So who's responsible?
You know what? That responsibility has to be spread across multiple professional disciplines. It can't be housed with the pharmaceutical companies alone, the doctors, the ER, hospitals, pharmacies, law enforcement. This is across the board. We all have some professional responsibility to help reduce and prevent the spread of these addictions.
Yeah.
But we can't lay it at the feet of one group the other.
So we just can't blame the doctors for writing these scripts. We can't just put all the blame on the patient for accepting the scripts. What if I only needed 10, what if I only needed 5 pills, but my script is 10, 15, or 20? Whose fault is it then, Dr. Janice Seabrook?
And again, I'm going to argue back. I'm going to push back on that, okay? Because the fault can't lay at the foot of one person. We live in a capitalistic society. And if those pharmaceuticals did not make any money, they would not be manufactured.
I'm speechless now because now we see, look, we opened up with the component of these drugs killing pain. Mm-hmm. That's what they're supposed to do. They have medicinal purpose to make sure that the patient can bear and have comfort during that time of pain. But when you blend capitalism into the mix, now we have drug companies who make a lot of money.
Huge profit margin.
Yes.
And the situation is so multifaceted that, you know, as you opened speaking about relieving pain, you know, we look at opiates and the prescription drug problem as a pain being relieved based on a medical need. But we leave out the fact that the vast majority of it has to do with emotional and mental pain that people are dealing with. Dr. Seabrook talked about, and you talked about, having a prescription for 10 pills and only needing 5, or what happens after the person doesn't need the drugs anymore and they start to abuse. Well, now we're looking at a situation where this individual no longer needs the medication for pain. Mm-hmm. Why are they taking the medication? Okay. Mm. They're taking the medication to deal with other things, to deal with other kinds of pain. Okay. So now you do have a physiological component that would stipulate that that individual may have become dependent on the drugs, but not at such a short interval and
Let's go further. So I talked about physical pain earlier, breaking a forearm years ago, access to morphine, open heart surgery, or, you know, a tumor on my heart, you know, obviously you need a pain pill for that. But you say other types of pain that aren't necessarily physical. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about
emotional pain. I mean,
emotional pain, low self-esteem, low self-worth.
So you take a drug. So you continue to take the drugs for those reasons?
To not feel, not deal, and not have to
just check out.
Check out. Exactly.
Because the reasons are multiple that people may do it. As in your case, a real injury, real surgery, you needed to cover that real pain that you were having. But again, you have people who have depression, people who want to check out, they may be having marital problems. The issues, the reasons are multifactorial. Why people, the same way that someone would slide off, so to speak, and drink too much.
And you start to use the drugs, like Dr. Seabrook is saying, for a particular reason, and then you get that aha moment. This feels good.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I could feel like this often. You know, I'm not worried about the bills. I'm not worried about the environment. I'm not worried about the husband. I'm not worried about being abused. I'm not worried about past abuse. I'm not worried about anything.
And so then
it becomes even more addictive.
Oh, wow. See, that's deep. We got to talk about this more in a second segment. That's heavy, because I noticed when you're just in physical pain, you just want relief.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But what's interesting is that, and really when you take the drug, you're really only concentrating on that physical relief. But once you're out of that pain, and if you're still taking the drug, the relief is different.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You it's like you feel the high as opposed to the pain disseminating.
And the kind of pain you're dealing with is much more intense.
What do you mean?
That emotional and mental distress is much more intense and bothersome than that physical pain that you might deal with.
You know, I was diagnosed with cancer in 2003, so that's why I had to have the surgery on my chest. And I noticed that after I didn't need the drug anymore, boy, oh boy, that euphoric feeling that the drug gives you, unless you go cold turkey on that, you can be in a world of trouble.
Absolutely.
Hold tight with me. Are Americans so dependent on opioids that the demand pressures doctors to prescribe for pain or insistence? How can we curtail opioid abuse and misuse? Car crashes, heart attacks, gun violence. Those were the leaders of death, but now painkillers have become the real killers. Ronald Williams, how do we treat addiction with dignity? So often, addiction can be embarrassing. Addiction can be filled with denial. Mm-hmm. I can quit anytime I want. I really don't need this heroin or this Vicodin or this next drink of alcohol. I can quit anytime I want. And don't you dare insult me by saying that I have an addiction. How do we treat it with dignity so the person doesn't feel as if they're belittled while being treated?
Well, one of the things that's high on my list is absolutely important and necessary is that the clients that we serve, the people that we treat, are treated with dignity mm-hmm. and respect. Everybody is trained and understands through, you know, their formal education and or being educated on the job that, you know, this is a disease. It's a situation that people have, that you could have, or anybody in your family could have. Yeah. Our government, one of our presidents had. I mean, for God's sake, anybody could fall prey to addiction. Mm-hmm. And so treating people with respect and dignity and being ethical and sound in your practice is first and foremost. And if you're doing that, then you don't run into those problems.
Good.
You know, we have the... The heroin use is so rampant now that you don't even have to drag them in. They're dragging themselves in.
Really?
And so once you get them there, that's when the job starts of having to treat them in a manner in which they would want to stay.
We're seeing more and more heroin users in emergency rooms all throughout Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana now.
Yeah.
Often occurs on Friday and Saturday nights when you get that rush of people who have overdosed, you know, and it's a frustrating thing. Dr. Janice Seabrook, you wanted to piggyback.
Yeah, I do. I want to talk a little bit about how to treat with dignity by not criminalizing what is going on.
Decriminalization. You believe in that?
But how are we going to prevent or keep people from feeling that they're safe to be able to come in and have that conversation with the crisis counselor if we're criminalizing their addiction.
It's a sickness.
So
it's not something that should be punished. Mm-hmm. It's something that needs to be treated.
Because when we make it criminal or criminalize it, we have people that stay in the shadows. And if I'm shooting up and sharing needles with someone who may be positive for HIV, then I am going to perpetuate the spread of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases if things are criminalized and the patients stay in the shadows.
Okay, so we've all seen The Wire on HBO a few years ago. It's where a very famous actor got famous, playing the character Stringer Bell. And we saw that The Wire depicts Baltimore at a time when drug use was the highest. Mm-hmm. They had a scene in The Wire called Hamsterdam. I want to see if the two of you agree to Hamsterdam. Hamsterdam, as opposed to, there's a pun, of course, with the word Amsterdam being in it. Hamsterdam on The Wire was a place where if you were a drug addict, you could go to that place in the city and do drugs, no matter how illicit, without being arrested by the authorities. Do you believe in that or not?
Well,
should there be Hamsterdams in every major city? Ooh, be careful, Dr. Janice Seabrook. I'm not trying to get you in trouble.
Well, I am someone who believes that until people are ready, I do not believe that needle exchange programs aggravate or elevate people's heroin use if they're already addicted.
You think it's for safety?
When I think of it and I think of what recently happened in Indiana, with needles being recklessly, you know, thrown on the ground by school lots and play yards where children could be, you know, harmed by them. If those people who are addicted would be able to take those needles in, pick them up off the lots, not leave them in the abandoned houses, and not leave them places for our city workers to get, you know, stuck.
That's
when
real.
They're trying to do their job. So it's not that it's affecting just that one person. It's affecting the entire community when you have someone who will recklessly and carelessly discard a needle in a not safe way.
Puts an influence on the whole village. This is interesting. So should there be limits to prescription? I know that's illicit or deemed as illicit, but should there be limits to prescription opioid quantities?
Yes, there should be, and recently the state of Indiana, along with using the inspect, passed several laws last legislative period in regards to limitations on prescription medications. Mm-hmm. Also, there has to be some type of written in your chart, where is this pain coming from, you know, where are the x-rays. Things have to be very well documented. Then the limitation on the prescription, and then patients have to come back in face-to-face in the office. You're not going to get an unlimited supply of opioid medications anymore.
So where does this pain come from, Ronald Williams? You know, why do we have more deaths due to opioid consumption than gun violence and heart attacks and car crashes now?
Well, it's like
over 40,000 a year now. Are we in that much pain physically, or are we in that much pain emotionally?
Emotionally, I think. I think that Dr. Seabrook is right. If we do take better care to monitor after we prescribe and ensure that the individuals who are using the prescription drugs need the prescription drugs, we'd be better able to, you know, curtail the amounts and the quantities that we put out there. However, I may get kind of controversial here, but we talked a lot about opiate use and prescription drugs. From my perspective, I've been in working in substance abuse field, about 25 years now. And
so you're a veteran of this.
Yes.
You've seen everything.
I've seen it. And it continues to transform itself. It continues to evolve.
So it's not stagnant.
It's not stagnant.
What you saw 5 years ago is different than you saw 2 years ago, and it looks totally different now.
But it's the same animal with a different set jacket on. You know, back in the 80s, it was in the 60s and 70s, it was heroin, mm-hmm. and heroin kind of stopped, and you always had the alcohol. Then you had a high incidence of marijuana, and then you went to crack a lot in the 80s.
Oh, crack was huge. Yeah. Crack was huge. New Jack City.
Right. Free Basin and then crack, you know, and then you start doing a meth and alcohol again, and then back to heroin. And it really has to do with whatever is popular at the time, whatever is more accessible at the time,
yeah, right.
whatever people are putting on the streets to make more money with at the time. But the one thing that stays stagnant is that people want to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start talking about it being a real big problem, we're talking about it now more so because of the areas that it spread to.
Yeah.
It's been like this or worse in the black communities mm-hmm. and in the lower socioeconomic class of people for years and years and years. This is nothing new. This is not something that is new to us.
But when it gets to the affluent,
it's a problem.
And also this is coming out of rural areas as well. And most people, when you think of substance abuse, you think of urban areas.
Right.
But the crisis right now, particularly in our state, is in the rural areas.
Breaking Bad.
Yes.
A whole Netflix multi-episode series dedicated to meth addiction and meth selling.
Mm-hmm.
80% of heroin users started on prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
How can we reduce the abuse? You got 80% start on prescription drugs. They no longer get the prescription from the doctor anymore. I think I need to try that heroin or that meth. Now, why do people go towards meth as we saw depicted in Breaking Bad? What is it about meth in the rural area? Is it the price point?
It's very cheap. It's easy to make. Mm-hmm.
What makes meth easy to make? The chemicals are easy to get?
The chemical compounds are available in pharmacies and grocery stores and the different big box stores, chain stores.
Dr. Seabrook, is that why they lock up all the drugs?
Cold medications.
Man, that really upsets me.
But there's a reason.
You got to fill out a card now to get the Sudafed and everything.
Or they have them behind glass with a lock on them. So you can make meth from something at CVS or Walgreens?
Yes. That's unfortunately, yes. But the breakdown of those chemicals is very volatile, mm-hmm. and that's why you hear about the different explosions and things like that occur. Now, our legislative body last year did not pass a phenylephrine and epinephrine bill that would also include those medications in the inspect. We would have just been inundated. I think it's a little bit better mm-hmm. the way that's being done now, just because those are over-the-counter medications.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you don't want to restrict someone who truly has a need for those medications.
Right.
It just reminds me of when we were little in elementary school, and sometimes, you know, one or two students in class would be acting out, and the teacher would say the good had to suffer with the bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to see any of my patients that could easily go, if they have a cold or a cough or something like that, to be able to go to the pharmacy. I don't want them to have to come and see me and get a prescription just to, you know, get an over-the-counter medication.
That's
such an inconvenience.
Yeah,
you know?
But when people are using, you know, Grape Pop, 7-Up, and NyQuil mixed together to make that lean, you know, you see why the stuff is locked up. You know, when people are using acetaminophen for the wrong reasons, it gets a little frustrating. Man, I really thank y'all for being here. I wish we could do a part two, but this is really, really deep because more people are dying from these opioids that are prescribed mm-hmm. than car crashes, heart attacks, and gun violence. We got to start paying closer attention to this.
I think the question that we need to answer is, the United States is 5% of the world population, but we get 99% of the opioid prescriptions.
Counterpoint with Jared McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore PBS, and the program is rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10. A new tool from the Indiana State Department of Health aims to help counties determine how to best respond to the opioid epidemic. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us about the agency's data that includes several important factors.
The Department of Health's Profiles offers a view of how the opioid epidemic is impacting Indiana communities county by county. Indiana State Department of Health Deputy Commissioner Pam Pontonis says the information is not meant to rank counties or serve as a comparison, but rather to give counties a snapshot of their risks and trends.
So they're not just shooting in the dark trying to figure out what might work. They have a better indication of what would work.
The data looks at factors including non-fatal emergency room visits and the rise in hepatitis C and HIV/AIDS cases. Marion County Health Department Director Dr. Virginia Kane says they can use the report to monitor how successful programs are.
We're really successful in doing the distribution of naloxone. We can save a significant number of lives related to this.
The profiles include data from 2011 to 2015, a time frame when opioid-related deaths increase an average of 3.5 times each year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Crown Point residents are invited to a public informational meeting next Tuesday evening to find out more about a proposed leaf and wood chips composting operation that's being proposed just off Iowa Street on the city's far south edge. Lake County Solid Waste Management District Executive Director John Manier told me more about it earlier today.
We're in the beginning stages of looking at a specific site. It's a site that we had looked at before, back in late 2016. And we're preparing information to go to the Board of Zoning Appeals. We're going to need a request for variance on the zoning because it's zoned agricultural and there's really nothing in the zoning that covers compost facilities. But this is, you know, a suitable use for this particular type of thing since it's basically taking leaves and turning it into soil. So we're right at the beginning stages of that process. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to have a meeting with residents that have expressed some concerns about what we're doing and make sure that they have the most up-to-date and accurate information about what the facility is and what we will be doing out there.
Tell us where the site's going to be located and what residences, if any, are around it.
The site is located just north of 231 and south of, I believe, 121st Street, kind of right in that little pocket. The actual working site is located in the very back of the property. There's about 140 acres in that area, and we're going to be working on about 7 acres of it. And the initial area that we're actually going to be developing is going to be about 5 acres. So it's tucked away in the back, surrounded by trees, so it's really not visible from the roadway, but that's kind of the general location of the site.
Seemed to be a good site to set up a composting operation out there?
Well, from our perspective, it is because of the shelter. It's surrounded by trees. Everything around it looks good as far as the geology. There's no real major concerns about discharges or anything of that nature. Naturally, we'll have to construct the site in accordance with stormwater runoff and all of those types of things. So we'll have some, very similar things that we had to do out at the Gary site. We'll have to do similar things there.
Now, speaking of the Gary site, on Monday, you and some folks were out there at the site to take a look at the trommel screen is brought out there to be used at the site. Tell us what a trommel screen does as far as composting is concerned and how it fits in with the operation out there and how it may fit in, I suppose, too, with the site that's being proposed in Crown Point.
Well, a trommel screen is just simply a machine that after the leaves have set for a few years, they're basically ready for processing. They're basically ready to be turned into a soil amendment. And so what the trommel screen does, it's a big machine that's got a drum that rotates around, and basically you load the leaf compost material into the trommel screen, and what it does is it separates the larger product from the finer product and creates a nice usable soil that we intend to sell to the local nurseries and also to our municipalities for use in their applications around town and with their retail market.
Now, obviously, it's going to take a long time, or it will seem a long time to some people when the composting operation is set up there along Iowa Street and Crown Point before it's able to be turned into real serious compost. And you're hoping that this piece of machinery can be used not only there, but any place else within the area that you're hoping to set up compost operations.
Correct. Yeah, the machine that we're looking at. And this was really kind of made possible. The purchase of a machine, trommel mill, is that we received a grant from IDEM. It's basically a 50-50. They provide us 50%, and we have to put in the other 50%. But that particular machine will be used at the various sites so that we can make that product. And we can speed up the process. We also have what we call a remove bucket, which is basically it grinds material into a finer product. So if we want to produce compost faster than a 2-year cycle or a 1-year cycle, we can run it through the remove bucket and it'll grind it up and it'll turn a material around in about 5 to 6 months.
That's pretty fast.
We typically use that bucket only for our food waste product right now. Mm-hmm. At the Gary site. The Crown Point site will not be utilized for food waste. We really focus our attentions on food waste at the Gary site because it's where we did the pilot, and that pilot has now moved into a full operation, and it's working out very well there. But we can still use the remove bucket for leaves if we want to. Let's say somebody has we know that somebody will have a need for product in 5 months. We can run the leaves through the remove bucket, grind that material up, and get it turned around in a 5 to 6 month period of time. Mm-hmm. And we did some of that. We ran some of the 5 month product through the trommel mill yesterday during the demonstration. And it turned out really nice.
That's great. That's great. One of the things I know that people are concerned about, especially if they live fairly close to a composting operation, and maybe the operation in Gary has kind of borne this out and proved otherwise, people think that the compost operation is really going to stink. And I suppose it depends what you put into the pile. And, of course, that's why you mentioned that there's only one operation that's using any of the food waste to recycle that back with the compost. And that's not, as you say, the plan for the proposed site in Crown Point.
All I can speak to is what the Gary site, if people want to go out and spend time out at the Gary site. What we do out at our facilities is we take great care on making sure that we turn product in timely fashions, that we don't bring in product that can have strong odors such as biosolids or grass, those types of material. Because citizens do have concerns, and we don't want to do anything that would escalate their concerns. So we take great care in making sure that we don't have water standing for long periods of times at our site, that we don't have materials brought in that can add to those odors. So, we've been operating at the Gary site now I've been here since 2015. We have had no verified complaints by the City of Gary's Environmental Affairs Department about any odors or any smells. Mm-hmm. They were out there yesterday as well and did not detect any odors. And we were actually turning product yesterday. So if you're going to smell it, that's when you're going to smell it.
As the informational meeting for the public about the proposed leaf and wood chips composting facility out on Iowa Street in Crown Point is going to be on Tuesday, May 23rd. It's going to be at 6 o'clock in the evening. It'll be held in the Commissioner's Courtroom, which is on the third floor of the main building of the Lake County Government Center in Crown Point. And I guess, John, you're hoping that most of the questions that people have to ask will get answered at this session?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are going to be some concerns. I'm sure that people, you know, are going to ask that we can't address. The typical one is, what about property values? You know, we're not, you know, predictors of what, you know, real estate markets can do. The real estate markets collapsed in 2008, and that had nothing to do with facilities or anything of that nature. It had to do with the economy. Mm-hmm. But this facility, you know, is not even going to be visible unless people drive back to it. So it should really blend into the you know, the landscape and the scenery in this area. So we're going to make sure that the entrance into the facility is nice and fits in with, again, the scenery and the basic aesthetics of the rural area out there. So, but we hope to address their concerns. We do know that one of the concerns that was brought up, that Iowa Street was a little rough and needed some repair. The county and the city of Crown Point have just resurfaced all of the Iowa Street out in front of, well, from 231 north. And so that issue has been resolved, and the way in which they redid that road, it's a pretty sturdy road. We're going to have some truck traffic, but not significant. But the way in which they constructed it will easily handle that kind of minimum traffic. We think that we can answer, if folks truly want to listen and truly want to hear, you know, what we are doing, we can answer those questions, I think, in a fair and reasonable manner.
John Menier, who's the executive director of the Lake County Solid Waste Management District, talking about next Tuesday evening's public informational session that'll talk about the proposed Crown Point composting operation there on Iowa Street. And that meeting, by the way, is going to happen at the commissioner's courtroom, which is up on the third floor of the Lake County Government Center. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.